Case number 13-1215, Sorensen Communications, Inc. Petitioner versus Federal Communications Commission et al. Mr. Wright for the petitioner, Mr. Pash for the respondents.
Mr. Wright, before you begin, let me just thank everybody for getting here. I know the weather's been bad, but we knew we had to hear these arguments today for our own schedule, so thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Christopher Wright, representing Sorensen Communications. I plan to address our arguments that the FCC failed to explain the unreasonably low rates it set for video relay service providers, and I also plan to address our argument that the FCC unreasonably singled out Sorensen for adverse treatment through the use of tiered rates. I hope to address the FCC's selection of an unreasonable 11.25% rate of return and its failure to count video phone and interest costs. A common theme to my argument today is the FCC's repeated failure to respond to significant arguments in the record. Each one of my five arguments involves that failure. Our first argument is simple. All the VRS providers told the FCC that they cannot cover their costs of providing service under the low rates that the FCC set, and the FCC simply did not say how it could ensure that it could fulfill its duty of ensuring the availability of functionally equivalent service for deaf people under that situation.
Do you mean they couldn't provide the services they're currently provided, or they could not even provide the mandatory minimum under FCC regulations at the new rates?
Okay. So, Your Honor, as it turns out, because the FCC made a change in its speed of answer requirements, providers cannot even meet the mandatory minimum requirements. This is an issue that I think is relevant to what you say. We have, along with all the other providers, we have sought a waiver of the FCC's change in the speed of answer rule. But it illustrates the unreasonableness of what the FCC did here.
And what's the status of that waiver?
I'm sorry, Your
Honor?
What's
the status of that waiver process for you?
It's pending at the Commission.
And how long has it been pending?
It's a few months, Your Honor.
Okay. Have they acted on anybody's applications for? I take it other people have applied for waivers as well. Has anyone's been acted on?
No, Your Honor. But let me use this to illustrate the problem here. The FCC has explained that the time it takes to reach an interpreter is analogous to the time it takes a hearing person to get a dial tone. The mandatory minimum prior to this order was 120 seconds. As the National Association for the Deaf said in its amicus brief, that's outrageous. That's not functionally equivalent service. If hearing people took 2 minutes to get a dial tone, there'd be an uproar. So in this order, the FCC decreased the speed of answer rule to 30 seconds, which is still very high. Now, providers can meet that standard if it's measured on a monthly basis, but they can't meet that on a daily basis. There are simply many examples of days when, on November 1st of last year, the Agriculture Department changed the rules concerning food stamps. They became swamped with calls. Deaf people are disproportionately poor. Many deaf people were on the phone on hold for a couple of hours waiting to have their food stamp questions answered.
So when the FCC said in its order that most providers were already meeting the 30-second rule, they meant on calculated monthly and not daily?
That's true, Your Honor. That is true, Your Honor. But the FCC somewhat embarrassingly said in its brief that it didn't realize that it mattered whether it was measured monthly or daily. And they also said that, well, the other...
Where does it say that?
In their brief, not in their order.
That it wouldn't matter? the result would be the same, but that it would not be... You would still be able to meet the standard.
if it were measured monthly?
Measured daily, isn't that their position? Yeah. And even if measured daily, you would be able to meet the standard?
No, there are many days during the year when Sorensen could not meet it.
You know, I understand that that's what you're saying, that the evidence shows, but as for what's in the FCC's brief, why don't you just tell me again what they said?
Right. They essentially said, well, nobody told us that mattered whether it was measured daily. That's why we sought a waiver, frankly, rather than bring the issue to this court at this time. But let me just say...
Can I clarify one other thing? When you say that no providers can meet the mandatory minimum under these rates, is that every provider has submitted a comment in the record? Because sometimes I see the word major providers and sometimes I see no provider. And I'm trying to be clear. How many providers said they could not meet the mandatory minimum under these new rates?
So, Your Honor, Sorensen, Purple, and CSDVRS provide almost all of the VRS. And I know those three did. There are three other smaller ones.
I think Convo did too.
Pardon?
Convo as well.
I don't know that the three providers who provide, you know, cumulatively a couple of percentage points said it. No one said that they could meet their costs. Now let me say, Your Honor, I don't know that anyone said they couldn't meet 120-second speed of answer requirement. Mm-hmm. What they said was, we are all providers. All of our costs are higher than the costs on that declining rate schedule you've set. Sorensen pointed out in one of our confidential filings the exact number at which Sorensen would go under that number, and the FCC intentionally went below that number starting in January of next year without saying a word as to why it thought that was reasonable, or it simply didn't acknowledge Sorensen's argument. And as the briefs have pointed out, Sorensen provides the majority of the video relay service that is provided. And this is a competitive industry. Users can use any interpreting service for any call. So how is the FCC going to ensure functionally equivalent service while driving providers below their costs?
So what percentage of providers said they could not provide under these rates?
At least the three providers who provide all but 3 to 5% of the service at a given month, and the other three, believe me, mm-hmm. cannot. They actually are too small to they certainly can't provide
those
service.
Those three are 95%? The three you mentioned are essentially 95% of the...
So it varies every month, Your mm-hmm. Honor. Users can use any provider on any call. Mm-hmm. And so it's impossible to say here is a market share.
Is there a rough percentage over time? Because I'm just trying to figure out how significant it is to have these people saying we can't do this.
Well, I'm confident the three providers who are very small have never mm-hmm. provided more than a small amount of the service. The FCC, you know, describes Sorensen as providing 80% of the service. Mm-hmm. Again, that can happen some months and not other months. But this is really a textbook example of unreasoned decision-making. The FCC, Sorensen, as you know, has gone into bankruptcy. It has done this to the industry, and it hasn't explained why it's doing this, and in the face of all the providers telling them that this would happen. In the brief...
First of all, the bankruptcy is post-record. I don't see how or why we would take account of that. Right. Second, the commission, if the commission's methodology was correct in principle, in particular in excluding the customer premise equipment, which was actually decided in the Tenth Circuit, then what seems to me your argument has been primarily that was an error, and if that were corrected, you would have had adequate rates. Right? But that matter is precluded.
Your Honor, the two largest rates that the FCC doesn't allow are costs related to video phones and interest costs as well. And they're both very important.
They dealt with that as well. Right? The interest costs are the result of an LBO.
I'm sorry, a result
of? The interest costs are the result of a leveraged buyout in which the company was saddled with the debt incurred by the purchaser.
Your Honor, the FCC did not say that in its order. The FCC said that in its brief, so that's post hoc rationalization of counsel.
You're right that that's what the buyout appears, but they did say that they wouldn't. That I thought they said that your interest costs were something they wouldn't take into cognizance.
Okay, Your Honor, they devote one sentence in paragraph 195 to the interest cost issue. It's a hard sentence to read.
Now, is the interest cost related to what is the source of the interest cost as far as the record reviews? Right.
It is partly related. I don't think the FCC is wrong to say that if the commission hadn't paid dividends, it could have paid down interest instead. But Sorensen's interest costs, in large part, relate to purchase of the company, which the FCC in its brief traces as well to sort of the cost of video phones, which they also don't allow. Sorensen in the 90s developed these video phones, which are the best video phones available and win in the marketplace, and it did so at a time when it didn't receive any money, and then the Sorensen family sold the company in the early 2000s. And the buyers borrowed money to purchase the company. And again, this isn't in the order, but in the brief and in discussions with the FCC, I know that the FCC looks at that part of the interest as big disavowable, not because of any dividends, but because it's tied to video phone costs.
Right. So the interest cost is essentially irrelevant to the arguments open to you, because that was properly because the customer premise equipment was properly disregarded in the rate base, and the interest relates to the acquisition and financing of that.
Right. So of course we disagree. But let me just say,
you disagree with the Tenth Circuit's already resolved that.
Yes, and let me explain that. Let me at least though make two points first. One, that sentence in paragraph 195 talks about high interest rates. That's all it says. We showed the FCC a chart that showed that Sorensen's interest rates are entirely typical of communications companies. The FCC ignored that. Just didn't explain that at all. So to the extent that they think Sorensen has high interest rates, that's another thing that we showed them just isn't true, at least compared to analogous companies. FCC didn't say they're not analogous, didn't say that they're too high in some other realm, and if they're too high, didn't say, well, what are reasonable interest costs that ought to be covered.
For how many years has the FCC excluded interest?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
For how many years has the FCC had its position that interest is excluded?
Well, for 2004 to 2005 is actually the answer, and only then. Mm-hmm. The FCC developed its system for calculating per-minute rates in the early 2000s, and in an order in 2004, it came to sort of the system that they describe in the brief as the system that's always been in place, and they set the rate for 1 year that way. The next year, the number that was calculated by the administrator was, I believe, 582, and providers went to the FCC and said, that's just too low, we can't provide service. So notwithstanding that, the FCC adopted a rate, I think it was 670-something. The next year, it adopted a price cap regime for 3 years. And, of course, under a price cap, allowable costs are essentially irrelevant. There's a per-minute rate. That's what a provider gets. The FCC kept collecting data, but it didn't affect the rates. And then FCC adopted the interim rate in 2010 that was supposed to be in place for 1 year, and it stayed in place until 2013. And that's when the FCC came to return to its 2004 rules that were in place that actually determined the rate only for 1 year. So that's the answer. Could I say a word about tiered rates?
Just 1 second. I think you misrecall what paragraph 195 says about interest rates. Because I think the relevant passage is at the end of the paragraph where the commission says, with respect to the paragraph sentence beginning with respect to the types of capital costs that are recoverable, goes on to say that it would be they're not going to reimburse all capital costs you may have chosen to incur, such as high levels of debt. And the implication is not that these are above normal interest rates, it's that there's a lot of debt on the books that has to be serviced. Right? It's high debt, it's not a high interest rate.
It's
a high debt.
High interest cost. I'm sorry.
So anything you may have said about showing that the rates were not out of line is irrelevant to that point that the FCC is making.
Well, I'm sorry, but in the interest, you know, Sorensen has high debt costs.
Right.
Sorensen explained to the FCC that it couldn't, that its operations would become unsustainable if a rate went below a certain level. And the FCC didn't explain how the deaf people can get service in that situation. Could I say a word about
it? In the sense that, as you related, you said you represented to them that continued service would be, quote, difficult if not impossible, close quote, at the rates that they're proposing.
We may have said that. I know we said unsustainable in the party filing.
There's nothing about even the subsequent post-record bankruptcy that assures that the service will be interrupted. It assures that the equity will be wiped out, that the debt will become equity. You may have a clean balance sheet and no interest costs, and no reason to disrupt service.
If the FCC had said in its order what you just said and gone on to say, and there's no reason to think service for deaf Americans will be interfered with if all the providers are go to unsustainable levels.
Well, the FCC says we're going to give you rates based on historical costs, and there isn't really a dispute about the adequacy of the historical accounting here, right, that NECA did. So they were going to give you interest rates per minute based on historical costs, using only those things that, for policy reasons, we agree go into the rate base. You're familiar with the telephone terminology, I know.
Yes. So.
That doesn't include the physical capital, the customer premise equipment, or the cost of financing it. So when you say to them, well, in that case, we can't make it, what are they supposed to say? Well, we're going to reimburse you more because you, one like others, incurred costs that are not allowable?
Here's our limiting principle, Your Honor. The FCC has a duty to ensure functionally equivalent service. We think the rate needs to be set to ensure functionally equivalent service. We don't think the rate needs to be set higher than that. We don't think 120 seconds is functionally equivalent service, but that's our limiting principle. The FCC has to set a rate, provide functionally equivalent service for deaf people.
Well, there are two objectives, right? Also an efficiency objective.
In this case, we don't disagree. The FCC says cites that efficiency sentence and says that means that providers shouldn't be overcompensated. We don't think providers should be overcompensated. We think providers should be compensated enough to provide functionally equivalent service.
Well, suppose the provider incurred imprudent capital costs.
If the FCC, so of course the FCC has never done straightforward cost of service regulation.
I understand.
If they did that, and if they said these were imprudent investments, we'd have a different order under review. But they just didn't say anything, Your Honor. about our claim that we can't provide service at the rates they set.
Well, they essentially said the effective result of what they said would have been the same if before the Tenth Circuit they had said these were imprudently incurred costs. So they gave a different reason, but whatever it is, the Tenth Circuit agreed that they're out of the rate base. So now they come along and say, well, with that out of the rate base, we can't provide functionally equivalent service. Right? So you may not be a provider.
Okay.
Then they say, well, they've got to provide comparable service. And they say, well, we've got to trade these things off in paragraph 207, 205. They say, we've got to do a balancing here.
So, Your Honor, if you read Section 225, I think what you will find is that, you know, the FCC is right that it doesn't have to overcompensate providers. But that doesn't give it the right not to provide functional equivalent service.
No matter how imprudent the costs were incurred.
Well, again, if they had actually said that and gone through that. But can I make one point about tiers?
Yeah.
Remember, Sorenson is the lowest cost VRS provider. It's undisputed that Sorenson can provide service at a lower per minute rate, even with its equipment costs and interest costs, than any other provider. The only reason Sorenson is insolvent at the moment is because the FCC continued this tiered rate structure for the next 4 years, even while saying in its order that the tiered rate structure is inefficient and should be abandoned. And so if the FCC had treated Sorenson like every other provider, Sorenson's would not be at the point that it's insolvent. It's only because the FCC intentionally took the Tier 3 rate below the level Sorenson told it was unsustainable in January of next year. And at the same time, the FCC expanded the range of the lower tiers in a way that protects the two other providers from every, the two other providers will not pay the Tier 3 rate until, well, they'll never pay it unless Sorenson loses all its customers, because they would have to gain a very large number of providers to do that. So this is in some ways, I think, our narrowest argument, but this violates the melody music principle. Sorenson is being treated differently from the other providers, and that wasn't...
Everybody gets the same rate on the first tier and on the second tier,
right,
and on the third tier.
Right. So the FCC could argue that in 2010 because it could say there was a reason to have tiers. The FCC has abandoned the argument that tiers make sense, and it has correctly abandoned it. It has said that it will, in the interim, maintain tiered rates because it is afraid that otherwise the other providers will become insolvent. Hello, FCC. We, Sorenson, will become insolvent at the rates you chose. Not a word in the order that we're protecting the other providers from insolvency while we're intentionally driving the low-cost VRS provider into insolvency. Just no mention of that. Why are they choosing to do that?
It's hard to understand that argument when your predicate argument in your blue brief was that everybody was going to go insolvent under these rates. And then by the end of your reply brief, it sounded like actually only you are going to go insolvent and the others are protected by the tiers.
Everyone will go insolvent if the rates that are in effect until July 2017 remain in effect. In addition to widening the Tier 2 level, the FCC also has that Tier 2 rate flatten out at $4.82 for the other providers until June of 2016. So everybody will go insolvent under the rate chart after June of 2016. At the same time the FCC protected the other providers, at least until then, it singled out Sorenson for a rate that will make Sorenson insolvent next January.
You're using a static assumption about the other providers, which the FCC specifically disavowed, saying that they're providing incentive for those providers to lower their costs as they go through this glide path. My last question, is Sorenson providing or service, or has it been disrupted?
Sorensen is providing service. This is a prepackaged bankruptcy, and Sorensen certainly hopes it will be able to get through this point without disruptions of service at this time.
Thank you.
All right, we'll give you a couple of minutes and reply.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Pash? Speaking for myself, it's been a long time since you've been up there. I'm glad to see you're still in harness.
I will take that as a compliment, Your Honor.
Well, when you get to be an old-timer like I am, it's nice to see a familiar face.
Well,
that's
thank
all
you.
I'm saying.
I often comment on the number of people who ask me in the elevator why I haven't retired yet, and I don't really have a good answer. But in any event, to get on to the subject at hand, it's surprising to me how personally Sorensen seems to have taken the commission's order. Mr. Wright said repeatedly that the commission intentionally went after Sorensen, that it's apparently Sorensen believes that the commission's goal is to put it out of business. That's a ridiculous proposition, since Sorensen provides 80% of the ERS service.
Can we talk a little bit about the daily versus monthly calculation on the speed of service? Is it right that when you all said the vast majority of providers are already doing 30 seconds, that meant monthly, not daily?
Yes, it did.
And then where did your order grapple with the fact that it would cost a lot more to do it daily rather than monthly, and the rates didn't allow any room for that extra cost?
Judge, well, it did not grapple with that because that argument was not before it. And as we argued in the brief, under Section 405 of the Communications Act, Sorensen or other parties who...
The argument was clearly before you that they could not meet the service requirement. You could disagree, but you didn't as to this issue, but that they could not meet all the requirements that you had at the rates that were being offered, that they could not provide service at the rates that were being offered.
I don't think
and this is just one manifestation of it.
But to the extent there was evidence before it, it was Sorensen's claims, and Sorensen's claims are based on the fact that assuming the costs that it believes should be applicable were allowable, its cost would not permit it to continue service.
I found in the record four providers who said that these rates would render them insolvent or force them to leave the market, particularly given the fact that when you combine it with this increased obligation, a significant increase obligation on speed of service. And I just didn't see any answer from the FCC to those comments and the concern, particularly since you misunderstood the reality of the situation with respect to speed of service.
I disagree with you that we've misunderstood the argument. The argument that they are making now, that going from monthly to daily would make them become insolvent or would at least not allow them to continue to provide functional equivalent service, simply was not before the FCC. The commission did not propose in its notice of proposed rulemaking to move from monthly to daily. Sorensen hasn't complained about that, and Sorensen or any of the other providers did not come to the commission after it adopted the daily standard and say, we can't do this. They filed a request for waiver of the rules. They've never presented to the commission the argument, and I would ask you to look at what they said in the brief. They simply made the statement.
I'm more concerned with looking at what the FCC said in the order, and it said that the vast majority of providers are already meeting the standard, but I guess you would agree that that's incorrect because the standard was daily, and you've said that the statement was only accurate as to monthly measurements.
I think, maybe I'm wrong about this, but I believe the commission was referring to monthly when it made that statement. It said that most providers were meeting the 30 seconds.
Well, it says I'm on JA 897 that most providers are largely meeting the 30 second wait time requirement we adopt today, and that's daily. We require in the beginning of that paragraph we require daily rather than monthly. So I don't know how you can say that they were talking about monthly rather than daily there.
Well, I guess I read something into that that's not there.
So are you agreeing then that in fact the statement here is just factually inaccurate, that there was any basis for the FCC to conclude that the providers are largely meeting the 30-second wait time calculated daily.
On a daily basis. To the extent that that's what that says, yes, I think that's mistaken. Because
well, if I'm misreading it, I'd love to hear what I could be reading it wrong. You have a much bigger context than I do.
Well, maybe my context is too big. But I think that... I think what was intended is not what's literally said there.
It seemed to me that your procedural point was the more useful one here, assuming that Judge Millett's reading is the complete and correct reading. That basically, there wasn't. What surprised me was that there wasn't an argument here that that the final rule presented a modification of which they didn't have notice.
I was surprised at that myself.
So instead, I think maybe because that was water over the dam, because instead, as you said, they let reconsideration pass and instead sought a waiver from this new standard. So they didn't contest. You adopt the standard as a kind of a surprise to them, maybe under the mistaken view that they could already make it, maybe just using loose language. And instead of coming back and complaining about it, they seek a waiver, accept the standard, seek a waiver from it. And now are here on a record in which they're not really at liberty to argue surprise.
That's correct. If I could just add, Judge Millett, I mean, one of the things the Commission pointed out was that all other forms of TRS service meet the 30-second, 85% daily measurement. And what the Commission was seeking to do was, because VRS had been accepted from the standard for many years because it was a newer service, the Commission was seeking to bring it closer to what other types of TRS were provided. And it's, you know, in other areas, Sorensen talks about the importance of functional equivalence. But in this case, where the Commission was attempting to improve the functional equivalence of VRS by reducing the wait times that the users face, Sorensen is functional equivalence doesn't seem to be
Well, I don't think they object to, as I read their papers and as I read what they were arguing to the FCC, is they don't object in principle to moving to a faster standard. What they object to is requiring them to move to that standard, and it's a big step when you go monthly to daily. At the same time, rates are being cut so significantly. I thought they had, they can correct me on rebuttal if I'm wrong, but I thought they had specifically argued that to the FCC, and it's the dual obligations of lower rates and the significant increase in speed of service that they objected to, and that's what they're objecting to here, and that's definitely not waived, is my understanding.
Well, I think it's, I would argue that it is waived under 405.
You can't, you have to object to the standard itself. You can't say we're content with the standard as long as you give us rates that allow us to provide that standard.
Well, they are objecting to the standard.
No, I think they're objecting to rates that don't let them meet the standard you set.
Well, I go back to my first statement. To the extent that they're objecting to the rates, the objection is based on the fact that the Commission refuses to include certain categories of costs in calculating the rate. That's how they get to the position that it's unsustainable, because if you exclude the costs that the Commission has determined in the past should be excluded, and which I would point out the Tenth Circuit approved the Commission's approach, then the Commission, based on what the TRS Administrator calculated, at no point during this four-year period are they being reimbursed at rates that are below their costs. It's only when you include these categories of costs, specifically their cost of debt and their cost of providing free equipment, that you can reach, that you can make the argument that they're not being reimbursed.
So he was wrong then. Counsel was incorrect when he said they could not meet the mandatory minimum requirements at these new rates, including within the mandatory minimum this new speed of answering requirement?
He was to that
argument only. I know there's other things they're trying to get reimbursement for that have been around the block a few times.
Judge, it's hard to know precisely what he said because I don't know that there's any factual detail beyond the claim. But with respect to other claims as to the sustainability of Sorensen's service, They are based on Sorensen's claim that the commission has improperly excluded certain categories of costs. That's how it gets to the what it claims, the specific claim it made to the commission was that it couldn't provide service at less than, I think, $4.37 a minute. And the commission, Sorensen's rates will go below that in January 2015. The Tier 1 rates will go below that in 2015. So it's only when you include those costs can it make that argument. If those costs were properly excluded, and we obviously believe that they were, and the Tenth Circuit agreed with that, then it can't, I don't believe that it can get to a point where it says that, where it can legitimately argue that the commission is refusing to compensate it at rates that will prevent it to provide service.
In your, with respect to your issue preclusion argument, are there any cases from this court that have actually applied that to rate making?
I don't know that there are, and I just
should
want to
matter or not. I'm just curious as to how, because in any given case, the rate's a new rate, and they argue that whatever the Tenth Circuit did, now things are even. It's a new record, and you guys compiled a very large record here, and it's whatever happened to the Tenth Circuit, it's much worse now. So how does collateral estoppel fit in with that situation?
I think it fits in, and they do cite several cases, I believe they're both from this court, that for the argument that issue preclusion never applies to rate making. I don't think that's correct. The two points that I think that we believe clearly apply, raise an issue of preclusion here, is with respect to the cost of equipment. They insist that the commission is obligated to reimburse them for their cost of providing free equipment to users. I think the one thing that's clear from the Tenth Circuit opinion that it simply rejected that as being required by Section 225. And secondly, the Tenth Circuit rejected the proposition that the commission it can appropriately establish allowable costs and establish its rates for reimbursement at a level that does not include unallowable costs. Mr. Wright argued at the end of his presentation this morning that's not the way to look at the statute at all. The commission's obligation is simply to establish functional equivalence and then reimburse providers for whatever costs are necessary to provide functional equivalence. The commission has never looked at this statute that way. The commission has been regulating TRS for 25 years. It has always thought that it had a responsibility to consider the cost as well as the responsibility to ensure the provision of functional equivalent service. And I think it's just unrealistic to think that Congress would have adopted a statutory scheme like this and not expected the commission to give consideration to the reasonable cost of providing a service.
Peculiarity is that the commission didn't go to an ordinary public procurement model from the beginning.
Well, I think the commission has certainly seen the wisdom of doing something like that, and that's the whole goal of what the commission is doing here. This is really the second step in the process. The commission obviously wishes it could do it more quickly, but the interim rates that were adopted in 2010 set the commission on the road to undertake a substantial structural reform of the video relay service. The order here contains, a third of this order is a further notice of proposed rulemaking in which the commission has clearly set out what it's going to do to address the problem it has faced for many years in establishing reasonable rates for reimbursing VRS providers. And the point of, as the commission, the term the commission used, is setting on a glide path in which it gets the provision of VRS service closer to cost, although based on the commission's calculation of what are allowable costs, it will never compensate providers at less than the cost of providing the service.
With respect to the waiver applications, do you have any sense of when those are going to be acted on?
No.
Is there a time period they normally take?
I don't know that I could indicate that there's a time period for this sort of thing. I know they're being considered. They're under consideration, but I really am not in a position to.
You know what criteria apply to deciding whether these waivers should be granted?
Well, the commission has a rule, and it basically is a general rule as to whether the that comes from my court cases, I think, is whether the continued application of the rule would be better served by waiver, whether the public interest would better serve by waiver of the rule than by its continued application. There's nothing more specific than that. But I'm sorry, I can't provide you with anything more specific.
And then I was curious about one cost that they mentioned, and that's the cost of acquiring the 10-digit numbers. And I know your test is, as the statute says, is costs that are caused by the need to provide service. And since you all require the 10-digit numbers, I was curious as to why that cost did not get factored into the rates.
I'm not sure I can give you a specific answer to that, Judge Millett. I think it may be because of the relation to equipment. But I'm
does the order not need to provide an answer to that concern? Because they raised the 10-digit issue.
I don't believe that was addressed in the order. I mean, I'd be glad to provide the court with a letter if there's anything that's in there. I really don't know. I certainly don't believe that's a cost of any consequence to Sorensen's provision of service. And if I could just make one more point as to Sorensen's bankruptcy filing, it seems pretty clear that from that filing, it's the first sort of specific evidence that we have as to Sorensen's financial situation. And there's certainly no evidence that the restructuring, its corporate reorganization and restructuring of its debt is going to have any adverse impact of on its provision of VRS services. The bankruptcy and the restructured loan envisions that that Sorensen's going to be in business at least until 2020, and there's no suggestion in those filings that I have read that they're likely to go out of business.
What district is that?
Pardon me?
Where is that pending? What district?
Delaware, I believe.
Do you have an answer that the amicus brief from the National Association for the Deaf mentioned what happened last time with respect to, I think, the Internet Protocol Services when the FCC cut rates below what people thought, what companies thought were sustainable, and people left the market in droves? Do you have an answer to why that isn't a concern here, or what happened in that situation?
My answer is that's an entirely different service that was riven with fraud, actually. That there was an enormous amount of fraud in that service that led to False Claims Act cases and criminal indictments. And as much a problem as the Commission has in setting rates for VRS, it's not had any problems like that. And so I think that is a different type of service that wasn't as valuable to the hearing impaired community, and I just think the Commission doesn't anticipate. And there's no evidence, let me emphasize, beyond Sorensen's claims, there's no evidence that that VRS providers are going to leave this business. No further questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Why don't you take 2 minutes?
Your Honor, let me start where Mr. Pash ended. AT&T and Sprint provided VRS until the 2010 rate cuts. Those two providers have already left the business even before the 2013 rate cuts. Judge Millett, yes, we object to the rate, not the functional equivalent standard. Prior to the 2010 rate cut, Sorensen was providing service at the 10% at 10 second speed of answer measured monthly. The rate that the FCC charges providers at that point was about 1% of their interstate costs. It is entirely feasible for the FCC to fund VRS that at least has a 10-second speed of answer measured monthly, and we know that because Sorensen was doing that when the rate was 623. It couldn't do that when the rate went down to 507. In 2010, and it won't be able to do that when the rate goes down to 349 for Sorensen next January. And that's just undisputed. Judge Ginsburg, it would be wonderful if the FCC went to a public procurement policy. There's absolutely no reason for it not to do that. It says it's going to go to a market-based approach eventually. There's no reason why it can't do it now. There's no reason why the rates that were in effect before the rate cut can't stay in effect until they do it now. Judge Millett, your questions about the FCC's speed of answering waiver requests or acting on anything. If you consult your colleagues, I think you'll know that there has to be a hammer or the FCC won't act. So they'll go to a public procurement approach if the rate is if the rate that was in effect before the rate cut is maintained until they do it. That's what they say they want to do. That's what sorts of things they ought to do.
Just the other way. If the providers are unable to continue providing, that would expedite their interest in moving to a public procurement. Right now, they really adopted the Medicare model.
Right. Judge Millett, the IP relay example from NAD's brief, I hope you understand that the and there's also going to be an IPCTS argument in this court in May. The FCC last year decided it was going to cut rates for everything involving service to deaf and hard of hearing. In the IP relay case, there were five providers before the rate cut. There are three providers now. One other provider says it's likely to leave. And the only remaining provider has moved all its operations to the Philippines and, by all accounts, is providing substandard service. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.